Okay, time for Ken. I've really been looking forward to this. Ken Clark has, written things over the years, and they're on the internet, and there have been so many people who have been influenced by his own personal story, and he's made it kind of a pet project to start tracking some history in the church that I think you will find very, very interesting. And without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Ken.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you. It's been so fun to visit with so many of you prior to all the big events starting in the conference, and it's just been great to visit with you. And some of you, I'm a horrible guesser. I'm glad I never worked for the circus and took money for guessing weight or something like that, because I always have these pictures of the names that you use when you post on various sites and stuff, and I haven't gotten one right so far. And I'm not even close. So it's great to meet you in person, and so many of you contribute so many good and rich things to my life because I read so much. We're going to raise your hand, or okay. Would you like me to do something different? Should I sit down and shut up? Yeah, what are you, a seminary kid? Jeez. Well, Harvey Tilden kept threatening to harass me. Harvey, where are you? Would you please stand up? Yeah. See, and you can't tell it, but he really is standing. So... No. So I have opened the door, and anything you want to do now is fair game. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Harvey. Harvey came down to Moscow and spent some time with Teresa and I, and we enjoyed his company very much. I'm from Moscow, Idaho. I worked for the church education system for 27 years, which may or may not be news to some of you. I was a convert in 1970 with my wife. Soon after we were married, and we were going to Central Washington University in Ellensburg, Washington. I'm a Washington State native, as is my wife, Teresa. And when the Mormon missionaries and a friend of mine who was teaching us some of the basic and rudimentary beliefs about Mormonism came to our door and began to teach us, my wife, with seriously more common sense than I'll ever have in my life, and she's just so smart and so wise like this. And anyway, she said, "This is creepy. I don't want to do this. Let's not join." I said, "Oh please, oh please, oh please. This is me. It'll be fun." So, this is what you get with an insecure show-off who loves attention. So, and so 27, we were in the church for about 32 years, 27 years. And August 5th, 2002 was the last day on the job. That's when I walked out of my office as the director of the Institute in Pullman, Washington, adjacent to Washington State University. Got in my truck, called my wife on the cell phone and said, "Can you meet me for dinner tonight?" And she said, "Yeah, how did your meeting go with the stake president?" I said, "Great." I didn't tell her that he said, "You need to bring in your paycheck stubs so I can look at those," because I was paying on my net income instead of my gross income. "You need to bring in your paycheck stubs, and your bishop and I will take a look at those, and we will determine how much you will pay if you want to keep your job in the church education system." As Paul Harvey would say, here's the rest of the story. After arguing with him about it, I'd just been released as a bishop a year later, knew the handbook pretty well, said, launched it to what I thought was one of the most profound lectures in the world, "You can't do that." He wasn't impressed. And furthermore, he said, I am told that when you go visit your family out of town, about 3 miles away in southeastern Washington, where I grew up, you do not attend church. Is that true? And I said, of course it's true. I'm not going to drive 3 hours and go to church 3 hours and then tell my family, sorry, I can't see you. Got to go home and go to work on Monday. Uh-uh. No, I don't. And he said, you will go to church. When you travel out of town, you will come back and report what ward you attended. And we will call that bishop and verify your attendance. So that's why I told my wife, it went great. I had him right where I wanted him. I told you she was way smarter than me. So I'm driving home in my pickup. She says she'll meet you for dinner. It went great. And we meet. And I just blurt it out and say, I'm quitting. I've had it. I'm through. And she was the happiest woman in the whole world. She just had been waiting patiently for me to come around. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the big hand because I'm stupid. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway, so that day we began deciding how we would go out. And so I left the church that day, and then I didn't care what I did for a job. I didn't care if I had been looking for several years. You need to know that. Even while serving as a bishop, I did not believe in the beliefs and practices of Mormonism. And I believe that's what made our ward so fun. And and demon-haunted ward, I might add, yeah. Anyway, and so then began the process. And then I had networked when I was working on my PhD up at the University of Idaho, and as an adjunct up there, teaching a course I had written for the religion and philosophy department and hoping to get on. But it was actually a friend who I'd networked with who had become the president of Lewis Clark State College that said, we might have something for you. So it was then that I ended my days of church employment. And then in September of 2002, that same year, I started work down at that small college where I still am today. Just a blurb. I hope you have your cell phone off. I turned mine off. One common thread will launch now. One common thread in most of our stories, you know, all of us, we have such a wide diversity. We have some who are thinking about leaving. There are some in the process of leaving, some where everybody in the family's left, somewhere, some are stuck in or still believe, and there's every kind of situation among us with regard to these things. But most everybody who has doubts and who begins to leave at one time or another usually says, I hate it that they lied to me. I just felt so deceived. I hate it that all those years I was taught all this stuff and I got up and bore my testimony. I taught the classes and said, it's true. And imagine what it feels like if you were paid to teach and you were spinning everything every day. So at a certain point in my professional life, I stopped the spinning, and that's when I started getting in trouble. But deception is the common thread. Today we're going to look at this as the Mormon Church uses deception and lying, prevarication, evasiveness, code words, all of those and more, as a practical management tool for their organization to keep members believing, practicing, and more importantly, contributing to this large, well-to-do organization. In a book published in 2008, Mistakes Were Made but Not By Me, by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson, they compile decades and decades of research on cognitive dissonance. And one line from their book, is this, that it all begins with self-justification, then self-deception, and then deception as you interact and interface with others. I'll just read the quote. Self-justification is a hardwired mechanism that permits us to sleep at night, but can also block us from seeing our flaws and mistakes. It's nearly impossible for humans to say, I was wrong and I'm sorry. For some reason, most of us don't see that as a virtue. We see it as a sign of weakness. So today, we are going to pull back the curtain just a little, like Dorothy and Toto, and we're going to look at how lying became instituted, how lying was instituted by Joseph Smith, how it was carried on by subsequent leaders to Smith, and how it's still being used today in a very effective way, but maybe not so quite effective as it was a few years ago. We are taught that much like the Wizard of Oz, that the leaders of our church are wise, purely benevolent, completely honest, benignly angelic, and nearly infallible. And that they only have the best of intentions for almost everything they do. Research tells us about humans that sometimes we're truthful and sometimes we're not quite as truthful with each other. Sometimes accidentally, sometimes intentionally. And we're all very similar in that way. It seems that the Latter-day Saints and their leaders wish, however, to take exception with that and not be part of the human race, but to say, we rarely, if ever, make mistakes because God is telling us what to do from moment to moment, day by day. Latter-day Saints are effective talkers. And I could have picked one of any 100 or more talks about lying or about honesty that have been given in general conferences or written in church publications or especially out of the seminary and institute curriculum given to the young people, where sober words about honesty are uttered by sober men in black suits in the conference halls. Marvin Ashton said, a lie is any communication given to another with the intent to deceive. So I thought, let's use Marvin Ashton's own words and juxtapose those against the actions of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from 1830 to the present as a way of highlighting how deception is such a practical management tool. The leaders are in impressive surroundings. The lights are darkened in the hall. There is literally a light from above shining on the shiny head of the person speaking. There, it is utterly quiet. It is a room full of people who literally idolize and adore this individual. And the individual was not introduced as Jerry or Dick or Richard or Ken or Sherry or... It's Marvin, Elder Marvin J. Ashton of the Quorum of the Twelve. And so that kind of impressive surrounding gives even more weight to the kind of authority that they are trying to project to the members. And it's very effective. Well, he said, sometimes we lie to avoid personal embarrassment. And I thought about Joseph Smith when he was caught by Emma having sex with Fanny Alger in the barn in 1835 when she was 17. And he quickly scrambled to self-justify that he had received a revelation from the Lord that he was to begin practicing plural marriage and that she was indeed his first wife, and then her uncle Levi Hancock solemnized the thing. Emma still sent her away. But I thought about that and thought, Marvin, you're right. Sometimes we do deceive to avoid personal embarrassment. He said, financial setbacks may be explained to others with untruths. And I thought about the Kirtland Bank scandal, where he declared boldly that God had spoken to him directly and said, you'll become wealthy if you invest your money, your savings, in the banknotes and in the bank. And when it all came crashing down, how many people lost their life savings? And in 1837, 38, hell of a lot of money for them. He said, Marvin Ashton said, sometimes people lie to destroy others. And I thought about the wonderful piece in Arza Evans' book, where he pays tribute to brave women, young women who Joseph Smith gathered affidavits because they turned him down when he proposed to them as plural wives. He gathered affidavits. He forced people, he persuaded people to lie by threatening to ruin them and ruin their character if they did not sign the affidavits. And he publicized that they were whores, mean harlots, and liars. And I thought, that's right, character assassination. It's through deception. I thought about when he said lies are often a lack for courage, excuses for lack of courage. Again, you think about Joseph Smith when he was caught lying about Nancy Rigdon's proposal by her father, and he handed Joseph the letter that he had written to Nancy following up on the proposal, and Joseph continued to dissemble. He said, there are some who would have us believe there is no right or wrong, that everything is relative. And again, I thought of the letter he wrote to Nancy Rigdon, where he said, that which is wrong under one circumstance and may be and often is right under another. After Nancy turned him down. And you know that the general authorities today pound on ethical relativism. It was one of Neil Maxwell's favorite topics. And yet, Joseph Smith is a shining example of ethical relativism. And finally, he who lies is the servant of the lie, and he who tells the lie must live with the results. That's not all the talking there is about lying and deception. In the Doctrine and Covenants, we read, wherefore I, the Lord, have said that the fearful and the unbelieving and all liars, and whosoever loveth and maketh a lie, and the whoremonger and the sorcerer shall have their part in that lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. In Doctrine and Covenants, section 129, verse 7, more very, very scary, tough talk about deception. It is contrary to the order of heaven for a just man to deceive. 2 Nephi chapter 9, verse 34, woe unto the liar, for he shall be thrust down to hell. So I think it's fair to say, by general authorities' speeches and by revelations to Joseph Smith, to ask, do they walk the talk? And so, Sarah Palin was the last person I heard say this. So I thought, hey, it really fits here. So I wanted to know. In 1985, I read the book by Valene Tippetts Avery and Linda King Newell, Emma Smith, Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith. I read it out loud to my wife, and we were so disgusted. But here I was teaching seminary for the church full time at the time. So I did start looking for another job right then. Actually, I did. And so I thought, you know what? They could be lying. They could be lying. They could be making all this up. What if something was taken out of context? You know those anti-Mormons are liars, and they take stuff out of context, and they twist and they distort. And you know how members of other churches, you know, they make these little pamphlets that just try to make the church look ridiculous and just try to make Joseph Smith look bad and try to make us as members look stupid? I'll show them, the liars. Harvey, what's your mom's name? He says Hazel Tilden didn't raise no dummies. So Doris Clark didn't raise no dummies. Well, and then I decided to go out and prove it because I was a seminary teacher. After all, when you were in a Sunday school class and they got stumped, who was the expert?
Ken, what do you think?
You know, like I know anything, okay. And so I decided I'm going to expose the anti-Mormons. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to show them. So I started reading and reading and reading everything I could, and I decided I would come up with this list, a long list of anti-Mormon lies. I wanted to defend the church. And the more the more I got into it, I learned that Doris Clark raised a dummy. Dang it. But it was my brother Jimmy. I learned that the lies were not isolated incidents. They were not things taken out of context. They were consciously developed and used as a management tool when they became a little more sophisticated about it. It was a consistent practice, and it was calculated and premeditated. I learned that anti-Mormon literature, so-called, got it right most of the time. That those like William and Wilson Law and others who had confronted Joseph Smith about his dishonesty and deception, about his adultery, were excommunicated and branded as apostates and enemies to the faith, and that the church history, the official history, was rewritten or sanitized to make it appear like those were nothing but evil men and women who questioned Joseph Smith. And I learned that lying as an institutional practice did not end with Joseph Smith, that you can find examples of prevarication, lies, deception as a management tool in every decade since the church was organized. At some point, I was lucky enough to meet SpongeBob SquareGarments, who operates the site Mormon Think, and his assistant Enigma and Diane Orman. And I asked if this might be something that we could put up on the internet. I knew that Richard Packham had an excellent expose on lying, as did another site, Rethinking Mormonism. But I just wanted to put the list there. And so we worked through the list and corrected some of the errors and put it on. But when I was working for CES, it was tough because ethically I had a dilemma. Yes, I was looking for work because I thought I can't work for these people and spin for them. I won't do it. So I would give measured doses of the truth from objective histories to my students at that point in the institute classes. And I kept getting into more and more and more trouble. Zone administrators were calling from Salt Lake on the phone. My area administrator was making special trips to drive down to Seattle just to see me. I felt so special. In one meeting that lasted 6 hours with two stake presidents and my area director, with stuff like, is it true that you told your institute students that you saw an R-rated movie? I said, yeah, Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, and I think they're great movies, and I think people ought to see them. And the guy sitting beside me, my area director, had been to see Unforgiven with me when we were at a church education symposium. I talked to him later, and he said, he forgot. Yeah, so I was getting scalded, roasted, broiled, and turned over and over. Yeah, I had stripes on my back where I was getting But then I asked him at one point during this, the roast, are you telling me to be dishonest with the students? Are those my marching orders? Just make it clear. We don't want you to undermine testimonies. Fine then. I have the truth and I have the sources and I can prove it's objective history. There's enough irrefutable evidence for most of, well, all of this stuff. What should I do about that? Don't quote that. Don't share it. That meeting was prompted because a 32-year-old law student had had questions about blacks in the priesthood. And I had invited him in my office there at the Institute. I was his bishop. He didn't come to Institute. So he came down there to my office, and I gave him Lester Bush's article on the history of blacks in the priesthood. And we discussed it. And he thought, oh my gosh, this is so refreshing. It's so refreshing that, you know, I kind of know how this stuff all went down. He called his dad, and his dad immediately called his general authority friend in Salt Lake, who immediately called his zone administrator friend. And the next, within 2 days, I had two zone administrators on the phone, and that's what led the meeting. So I wanted to know. And it was, don't undermine their testimonies, and okay, what about this? Don't teach it. But it's true. Don't utter a word. And so the message was clear. You will deceive if you want to keep your job. And you will spin it the way we tell you to and sanitize it if you want to keep your job. So I know a little bit about this deception thing. Now, I want to say up front, Mormons are not the only group, only organization that deceives. I am well aware of that. Whether it's a secular or a religious organization, yes, individuals and the group as a whole sometimes sponsor deception. I understand that. But I'm not at an anti-Jehovah's Witness conference today, so we're going to focus on Mormonism. This is what we're going to, the outline will follow. Joseph lied, and of course the superstitious believed. And I underscore that. It was the fringes of society, those that had their own little peepstones, those that had their rod that they would either set on the table and wait for it to move when they ask it a question, or hold it in their hand and use it as an aid to revelation. It was these people who were rodsmen and seers and who used peepstones that followed Smith, not the public as a whole. Smith legitimized and institutionalized lying as a management tool. We'll look at how he did that in some ways. 19th century leaders after Smith used lying as a management tool. And we'll take most of those examples from the battle against the Mormon Church and the federal government over theocracy and polygamy, because polygamy was an issue, but it was not the biggest issue. Really, the theocracy, the whole theocratic movement of Mormonism out in Utah, and their unwillingness to bend their will to the laws of the Constitution of the United States. And then current leaders continue the tradition. And finally, we'll look at some research on lying and what it tells us about what we probably, well, what we need to know. So quickly, running down. Joseph was able to influence the gullible and those people that believed in magic and had a magic worldview, because he was appealing to them on their terms. And so when he spoke about buried treasure, and when he told them about a rock and a hat, and pulling the rock over his face to exclude the light, and spiritual light revealing to him at first where underground subterranean treasure was, and then later gold plates and angels and prophets, he was appealing to a people who believed that sort of thing. Those people on the fringe of society that used them, those tools themselves. Joseph Smith reported seeing spirits that guarded the treasure. He reported that when when they dug and knocked off a piece of the treasure chest, that you could hear a rumbling as it slipped away through the ground. The people who were digging behind the shovels believed. And he sacrificed a black ram. One fellow talks about it in an amusing way, whose ram it was, and bled the ram in a circle. He pounded sticks in the ground in a circle. There were incantations to keep the treasure spirits from moving the spirit. And so it was always a new excuse when the treasure got away. And of course, they never found anything. Sometimes it was gold watches. Sometimes it was Captain Kidd's treasure. And sometimes it was silver. And sometimes it was all of the above. But the magical thinkers of his day who thought like he did thought this was wonderful, especially when he transcended the purely secular, I want to make money, raw confession to, it's been revealed to me that there are gold plates. And a spirit later became an angel. Early Mormons used to talk about the spirit that appeared to Joseph Smith, and later Latter-day Saints and historians revise that, and they say angel all the time now. And so it was effective. His mother said that before he found the golden plates, before he supposedly learned through translation about the ancient inhabitants of America, he used to entertain the family with stories about them. Quote, he would describe their dress, mode of traveling, animals upon which they rode, tapirs, their cities, their buildings with every particular, their mode of warfare, also their religious worship. This he would do with ease, seemingly as if he had spent his whole life among them. And his mother was glowing with pride as she related it. The church histories leave out his devotion to the occult and magic. They're embarrassed about it. D. Michael Quinn says there's nothing to be embarrassed about in Mormonism and magic worldview. As a member of the church, when I was always embarrassed about it. I just thought it sounded so hokey. He and his father owned magic parchment. He wore a Jupiter talisman. He was wearing it the day he was shot. He persuaded people by lying and through the use of cheap magical tricks. If you keep digging, you will find the tail feather of a, I forget the bird. So, lo and behold, they dig a little while and you never guess what they found. A tail feather. I submit that is proof that he was a prophet and a seer. His mother kept an old wood chip that supposedly was part of a treasure chest that was knocked off when they were digging just before it rumbled and slipped through the subterranean earth, before they were unable to capture the treasure. So, the Bainbridge trial. I'll call it an examination. The apologists insist it wasn't a trial. It was a pretrial hearing or whatever it was. He was found guilty. And when I was reading about this, it was fascinating to me that his defense was, I am not an imposter. I am not guilty because I really can find treasure that way by use of a peepstone in the head. And his witnesses all came to the stand, took the oath, and solemnly declared, he is a true seer. He can find buried treasure. Has he ever found any? No, but it keeps slipping away. Jeez. Use your head, Judge. He was found guilty of the law, pretending to discover where lost goods would be found. And so, after being pronounced guilty, he was given what some call leg bail and allowed to leave the state. Book of Mormon translation. Nothing in it is ancient, though it's a book about the ancient inhabitants of America. nothing about the languages that he describes has any kind of proof or evidence that supports it. Archaeology does not support it. There are wonderful arguments now about where it all took place. And if you're talking about a magical place, there might as well be lots of arguments about it. It's something to do. We could get out J.R.R. Tolkien's maps and say, well, where do you think this took place? Harry Potter? There's Hogwarts. Where do you think it really is? Yeah. So, there's virtually nothing to support anything, the claims that Joseph Smith made about the Book of Mormon. And so, we know that errors in the King James Version in his 1796 version crept into the Book of Mormon. This into the most correct book of any on earth, because it was translated by the gift and power of God. And we know where he plagiarized a lot of the other material for the book too. And we know, as his mother tells us, he was prone to do this long before he found the plates and decided this would be a good way to probably make money, among other things. His scribes and his family members, those closest to him, tell us the plates were not present when he was, quote, translating, unquote, face buried in the hat, reading the illuminated phrases that appeared on the peepstone. So he says, then why did you need to discover them? If they weren't ever there, they become inconsequential and unimportant. If you want to see the gold plates, however, they're in Moscow, Idaho, in the Institute of Religion, because some guy made a facsimile or something and thought it'd be cool to, yeah, and we use them as a door prop. So, David Whitmer, Martin Harris, and others said the plates were often in the woods. The Book of Abraham translation is an obvious prevarication. No credible translation supports Joseph Smith's translation claims. Nothing was written by the hand of Abraham, as Joseph Smith said. It is not an account of Abraham by Abraham. Not even a fragment that is in existence matches anything that dates to the time of Abraham. Nothing said, Joseph Smith said, about the translation is true. You ought to try to teach that in an institute class. Yeah, the thing you do is just say to your colleague, would you teach that this semester? What do you do? You know, because I was already getting in trouble for not being orthodox. That's the word I kept hearing. And I asked them, isn't honesty more important than orthodoxy? Don't undermine their testimonies. The Kinderhook plates. Gotcha. The ruse was a success, found in Pike County, Illinois, 1823. The plates were rigged up by a fellow named Wiley and his friend named Harris. And this is what Joseph Smith told his confidant and personal secretary, William Clayton, when he examining these fake plates. I have seen six brass plates covered with ancient characters of language containing from 30 to 40 on each side of the plates. Someone correct me. Weren't these characters, the inspiration for these characters, an old Chinese wooden tea chest that were the, yeah. Yeah, anyway, that's what they used. So, nah, they're Egyptian, you liars. Okay. President Joseph has translated a portion and says they contain the history of the person with whom they were found, and he was a descendant of Ham. Through the loins of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and that he received his kingdom from the ruler of heaven and earth. William Clayton's Journal, May 1, 1843. How can you trust Joseph Smith when you can check on him and nothing checks out? Very difficult. Couple of other situations with Joseph. Joseph believed, apparently, through writings he put in the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham, that if you really need to, God says it's okay to lie. In the Book of Mormon, not only lying, but murder was okay if you were really in a jam. I have thought that before. Yeah. No, I haven't. People thought about me, probably, but yeah. And in the Book of Abraham, God commands Abraham to lie. When Abraham is before Pharaoh, so that Abraham will not lose his life and tell Pharaoh, Sarah is my sister, not my wife. I love it. I have been commanded many times by God to lie myself. So, I think I understand. So when you have characters in the book lie, it says more about the author than it does about truth. The first vision. You know about the multiple contradictory accounts. You know that the 1832 account, the earliest, is handwritten in Joseph Smith hand wrote it. You know it's a Christian epiphany being described, that probably a good number of Christians felt they had received under inspiration in those days too, as they imagined Jesus after prayer forgiving them of their sins. It does not mention God the Father as one of the visitors who appeared to Smith. It does not mention religious excitement around the Smith's home. It does not mention persecution by enemies, nor being attacked by the devil, nor being told by Jesus to remain aloof from the Christian churches, which Jesus called apostate. The 1832 vision resembles a common Christian epiphany. The later accounts, coincidentally, become more remarkable, with even more detailed and specific information, more extraordinary. Some have suggested that the later accounts serve several purposes, but at least one was to head off at the pass certain turmoil and trauma within the Mormon community so that Joseph Smith could preserve his standing as the president of the church and the prophet. Extensive and conclusive research on memory is pretty clear. As time passes, we all tend to embellish our memories and add events that did not occur. And as my wife will tell you, forget really, really important events that did occur. Subconsciously attempt to make ourselves look more credible, more competent, more intelligent. That's how we humans are wired. Dan Gilbert, in Stumbling on Happiness, talking about memory, said, "We tend to cook the facts to maintain or move toward greater happiness. A negative situation is rationalized as it wasn't that bad, really, or likely an experience that didn't happen the way we insist. Our memories tell much more about what we believe and want to believe about ourselves than what really happened then." The priesthood restoration. Nothing is found in the early documents about the restoration, about priesthood restoration. It crops up about 5 years after the priesthood restoration was supposed to have occurred. David Whitmer, in an address to all believers in Christ, said, didn't happen. I was with him the whole time. Did not happen. That was he and Sidney Rigdon's little invention. More than 400 words were added to a revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants, because none of this stuff appears in the Book of Commandments. None of it appears in any of the early revelations. And of course, there's still no date for the Melchizedek priesthood restoration with Peter, James, and John. Kind of hazy on that one. And then there are so many competing and contradictory accounts that the evidence is pretty firm. It never happened. One very important, I think, deception that's still carried on is by a sanitized church history is that the church leaders did not profit from their positions as leaders of the church. And it's the evidence suggests otherwise. It's the kindest way to say it. One example, Sarah and Maria Lawrence immigrated to this country from Canada. There you go. Man, I was waiting. Okay. And they were orphans and worth about $8,000 in English gold. I believe it was Josiah Butterfield. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I was wrong. See, it feels good. I believe it was Josiah Butterfield who was appointed as their guardian first, and then Joseph Smith took over that responsibility, moved the girls into his home, of course, married them, so to speak. And when he died, A.W. Babbitt became the guardian of the two girls and went to Emma to get their money. He found that about $3,000 was removed from the account by Joseph for room and board and clothing. Babbitt said, okay, whatever. Where's the $5,000 that remains? It could not be found. William Law, in an interview speaking about this incident, said, Babbitt was a straight, good, honest, sincere man. He could find none of the money. But Joseph left two splendid farms near Nauvoo, a big brick house worth from $3,000 to $4,000, the hotel that Joe had kept, a mass of vacant town lots. All had been transferred to Emma's name. Wilson Law said, and this is the fellow whose character is constantly blackened by church history, William Law stood up and said, I saw how things stood. And he ordered his property in Nauvoo, Illinois, to be sold and the money and the proceeds given to the Lawrence girls. Nothing from the church, nothing from Joseph Smith's estate. Smith, sent people on a couple of different expeditions because of revelations he received to go to this town and find gold or great treasure. And on one of them, he came back, after they came back empty-handed, and announced that some revelations are of God, some are of man, and some are of the devil. That's such a firm explanation. It's just something you can sink your teeth into. Brigham Young, second president of the church, died extremely wealthy. He declared personal property worth $102,000 and real estate valued at over $1 million. He drew on the tithing resources of the church and at a later date repaid part or some of the money or services. No interest was ever paid. The ability to draw almost at will on church as well as his own funds was a great advantage to Brigham Young. You think? The Kirtland Bank scandal. Wilford Woodruff recorded this revelation by Joseph Smith about organizing the bank. He declares in the presence of fellows he names and others in the deposit office that he, Joseph, had received that morning the word of the Lord upon the subject of the Kirtland Safety Society. He was alone in a room by himself, and he not only heard the voice of the Spirit upon the subject, but even an audible voice. He did not tell us at that time what the Lord said upon the subject, but remarked that if we would give heed to the Lord's commandments, his, Joseph's, that all would be well. Wilford Woodruff's journal. So when Smith and his friends applied for a bank charter, you remember the story, they were turned down. They already had the bank note printing plates made, so they changed them to read Anti-Banking Safety Society, something like that, yeah. And Smith ordered notes to be issued anyway, and they were stamped to read Kirtland Safety Society Anti-Banking. You know, you could have got a clue when they issued a $3 bill. But after the bank and the Kirtland community failed, several former bank executives, all Mormons, testified that Smith and Rigdon had placed a chest filled with junk in their bank's vault with a thin layer of silver coins on top to fool people who wanted to check on the reserves, to let them know they had plenty of capital to support the notes. You know that Joseph Smith was caught red-handed by Emma, according to William E. McClellan, before receiving any revelation authorizing plural marriage, before receiving any sealing power. And this is, he scrambled to find a way to explain and legitimize his adulterous activity with the teen Fanny Alger. McClellan said, Emma Smith looked through a crack and saw the transaction in the barn. My wife has a favorite saying. And she doesn't even put it in a sentence. She just puts it out there and says, Lorena Bobbitt therapy. Church leaders and apologists evade linking Smith with his adultery and call it an authorized plural marriage. I don't know. Yeah. Joseph Smith lied to his wife. It's a terrible thing to be accused of having seven wives when I can only find one. Those kinds of things. He lied to his mistresses. The church recently, in an Ensign article, September 2008, wanted to convince its readers that Joseph and Emma were totally honest and completely in love. Joseph and Emma sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. I like to bring a more mature ambiance to all of this. They did not publish in the Ensign an August 18, 1842 handwritten letter, love letter, that Joseph Smith, age 38, wrote to Sarah Ann Whitney, age 16, whom he had already secretly married without Emma's approval or knowledge. And the letter was to arrange a meeting between them. He used deception to keep his numerous sexual dalliances and clandestine adulterous extramarital affairs from Emma. This is what the letter said. Part of it. The only thing to be careful of, Joseph wrote to Sarah, is to find out when Emma comes, then you cannot be safe. But when she is not here, there is the most perfect safety. Only be careful to escape observation as much as possible. I know it is a heroic undertaking, but so much the greater friendship and the more joy. When I see you, I will tell you all my plans. I cannot write them on paper. Burn this letter. Oops. As soon as you read it, keep all locked up in your breasts. Only Joseph had the key. That's not in the letter, I think. It's inspired version. My life depends upon it. I close my letter. I think Emma won't come tonight. If she don't you fail to come tonight.
Ah. Somebody's got to write a poem.
Huh? No, it didn't. I meant for it to do that. I'm not wrong. Hold on a second, please. Don't look at my password. Yeah. No, it's 1, 2, 3. No. No. Okay. Anyway, that's the letter. And doggone it, they couldn't remember to put that in the Ensign article about love. Here's a rest of the story sequel to that. In April of the following year, Sarah Ann Whitney publicly married Joseph C. Kingsbury. Kingsbury said of this marriage, quote, "According to President Joseph Smith's counsel and others, I agreed to stand by Sarah Ann Whitney as supposed to be her husband and had a pretended marriage for the purpose of bringing about the purposes of God in these last days." I wonder what Elder Ashton would say about that. Of course, the story of the angel with the drawn sword used as a ruse with several women, that he was commanded by God to practice polygamy or he should be slain immediately, and only they could save his life by saying, yes. I won't tell you what my wife said Emma should have done to his flaming sword. I tell people my wife doesn't like to come to these, but in truth, I don't want her here because she's mean. Now, let's go through some lists. The Danites, a Mormon vigilante group, burned, plundered, and drove Missouri citizens out of their homes in 1838. Justice Morris described how he and others were directed to protect a fellow Mormon from prosecution by lying to, quote, "Do it with such positiveness and assurance that no one would question our testimony." In an article in the Messenger and Advocate, June 18, 1845, Sidney Rigdon admitted that Parley P. Pratt advised church leaders how to support Smith and advised that we must lie to support Brother Joseph. It is our duty to do so. What power an organization has when authority figures can turn ethics and morals and principles on their head and becomes your duty to lie to protect them. Above all else, do not betray your friend, Joseph said. He frequently reminded members that they should honor friendships above all else, even unto death. Loyalty trumps honesty in the LDS Church, still. Joseph counseled the Relief Society sisters. No, wait. Don't be too overzealous in the search for wrongdoing and to be charitable toward the accused after counseling them to seek out evildoers just months earlier. Joseph Smith threatened Sarah Pratt after she turned down his proposal for marriage. Wife of Orson Pratt? Is that who Sarah was? Okay. Sarah recalled Smith's threat, "I will ruin your reputation. Remember that." Smith later launched an all-out public campaign against her and called her in the publication, probably whore, from her mother's breast. Joseph and the church must be saved. Still about Sarah Pratt. Somebody pronounce that name. Zariah? Okay. Signed a false statement against Sarah Pratt. It was added to dozens more slanderous and libelous statements because some were verbal, some were written. to smear Sarah. Goddard confessed years later that Hiram Smith came to our house with affidavits all written out and forced us to sign them. Joseph and the church must be saved, said he. We saw that resistance was useless. They would have ruined us, so we signed the papers. Church leaders broke civil laws and lied to promote polygamy and protect Smith, and they engaged in character assassination to protect him. And that's from Richard Van Wagener's book. And, of course, there's more examples than that we could use. The laws, the parishes, and others. Martha Brotherton, 18-year-old convert from England in 1842, immigrated to Nauvoo, Illinois with her parents. Brigham wanted Martha. Joseph, I'll arrange it. In a room with Brigham and Joseph, Martha said no. More cajoling, more persuading. No. Please let me go. More cajoling, more persuading. Joseph went so far as to say, if you don't want Brigham, then you can divorce him and I'll take you. She said no. Finally, she convinced them to let her go, because you know why they were afraid to. And so, under the condition that she would deceive her parents and not tell them anything about the meeting, she was allowed to leave. She told her parents everything immediately. They talked to some people in Nauvoo. They packed. They left. She talked to a reporter for the St. Louis Bulletin, and her account was published July 15, 1842. Of course, Smith denied everything, and the damage control machine went into motion. He issued false affidavits, just as he, as with Sarah Pratt, and statements that labeled Martha a liar, apostate, and mean harlot, with other salacious rumors that weren't true. Fake excommunication was used at times. When William Clayton was afraid that neighbors were talking about the new plural wife he had just taken, Joseph said, if they raise trouble about it and bring you before me, I will give you an awful scourging and probably cut you off from the church. Then I'll baptize you and set you ahead as good as ever. That'll fake them out. Orson Pratt admitted he deliberately misled his listeners regarding the practice of polygamy, but he did not consider it to be lying. It was done to protect a higher law than man's misguided laws. Joseph Smith considered the saints, the adults, to be little children in spiritual stature, perhaps in intelligence, because they're little children. They're unable to bear all things now. It's for their own good. Those of you who are in the counseling profession recognize this as classic abuse. Keep the secrets. It's something you talked about the other day as codependency. Don't tell the secrets. It's for your own good. I'm trying to protect you. Well, leaders after Smith lied. And in fact, we'll talk about how it led to the creation of the fundamentalist polygamy movement going on today. After Mormon lobbyists assured congressional members in Washington, D.C. they no longer practice polygamy in Utah with the approval of from the first presidency, Apostle John Taylor admitted to church members in Nephi, Utah that the statements made in Washington were a damn lie. Probably to reassure them. Expediency. Charles W. Penrose, apostle and counselor to two presidents of the church, admitted that after Joseph's death, certain facts about him were purposely withheld from church publications for prudential reasons. Yet at the same time, you can read in the church history, everyday members were tried in high council courts for their honesty or lack of it, as lack of Christian conduct and such. Lying was so prevalent as an institutionalized scheme that they brought back the old William Clayton ruse among church members, 1860s to 1880s. John D. Hicks revealed that when polygamists were prohibited from voting, the Mormons promptly swore that they were not polygamists. When those who taught or practiced polygamy were discriminated against, everybody immediately became silent on the subject. When members of organizations which advocated polygamy were denied the ballot, they withdrew from the Mormon church. Of course, their names were still kept on the records of the church's members, but they withdrew, to become eligible to vote and support the church. A church authority would say that he no longer gave recommends for marrying plural wives, but he gave them for obtaining, quote, whatever blessings the Lord might bestow. And you all know that a lot more code words than this were used, and they began in the Nauvoo period. Code words assured the faithful that recommends for plural marriage were still being issued. Don't you worry your pretty little heads about that. While misleading the American public to make them believe that the practice had stopped. Evasive and code word and other rhetorical techniques are still very effective communication tools used by the church today, where an audience member who's one of the initiated understands the esoteric language being used perfectly, while the unknowing and uninitiated public receive an entirely different message of assurance that whatever they're denying is in fact something they are not practicing. Beating the devil at his own game. Thomas J. Rosser was a missionary in Wales in 1908. He asked his mission president, Charles W. Penrose, if the 1890 manifesto, supposed to ban plural marriage but did not, was a revelation from God, making known to a long answer, brethren, I, Charles W. Penrose. I just want to talk like that. Wrote the manifesto with the assistance of Frank J. Cannon and John White. Then, continued Penrose, Wilford Woodruff signed it to beat the devil at his own game. John Henry Smith, apostle, remarked that the manifesto was only a trick to beat the devil at his own game. Joseph F. Smith said something in a meeting that Florence Ivins, daughter of Anthony W. Ivins, remarked about in one of her journals. She asked her mother why her father was so upset after a meeting of the apostles and the first presidency. President Smith said he would lie any day to save his brother. And Florence's mother said it bothered her father. Matthias Cowley quoted a member of the first presidency who said he had taught him that he, the member of the first presidency, would lie like hell to protect the brethren. Fake political parties. During the 1890s, opponents charged that a theocracy existed in Utah, and church leaders controlled all the elections. Leaders instructed members to pretend to align with different political parties then. George Q. Cannon said that the political gains were made sincerity irrelevant in this case. Matthias F. Cowley stated in a hearing before the Quorum of the Twelve in 1911 that he had been chastised for asking permission to predate post-1890 plural marriages to make them appear to have occurred before the manifesto. He said he was trying to illustrate, quote, the training I have had from those over me, and that training was to act with duplicity without asking for permission in order to preserve the image of plausible deniability for the church hierarchy. Again, a practice alive and well in 2008. Ironically, after claiming he'd been taught to lie by previous leaders, Cowley also claimed, I am not dishonest and not a liar, and have always been true to the work and to the brethren. We have always been taught that when the brethren were in a tight place, that it would not be amiss to lie to help them out. Stop calling me a liar. Constant lying by leaders of the church led to the belief that plural marriage would always continue secretly while being practiced. Well, being denied publicly, practiced privately. Wink, wink. Dozens of prophecies declared that polygamy would never be repealed or the Lord would reject the Latter-day Saints as a church. Dozens of them. D. Michael Quinn's Post-Manifesto Plural Marriages, one of the best articles you'll ever read on this, and then B. Carmen Hardy's Solemn Covenant. Really, in fact, Hardy has an appendix
called Lying for the Lord in the back of his book. If you haven't read them, you will like them. Great, great resources and references. So taken together with, well, the leaders say one thing in public, but they really mean another with the deceptive code words and the prophecies and by the prophets that we will never abandon polygamy or else we will be rejected by God as a church, gave birth to the modern fundamentalist polygamy movement, who continued to practice feeling absolutely justified that they were continuing the work of the Lord. Lying became such an integral practice with the Latter-day Saints, church leaders instructed members how to lie about polygamy, according to the testimony of members given under oath. And you all have a rich heritage. I'm a convert, so I don't have this, but you probably have a diaries, journal accounts, and stories from your ancestors that talk about these very things, about when the federal authorities would seek to arrest someone or question a child or question a family member. They lied. They would not give straight answers about their name, where they lived, who their parents were, who their brothers and sisters were. And what do you see when they raid a place like Waco, Texas, where there's a fundamentalist compound? You can't get the truth out of the kids, the husbands, the wives, anybody. It's a long-standing tradition. Henry S. Tanner explained that Mormons would be regarded by God as having made no promises, nor be accountable for lies told to protect the church. Tanner and others blamed the government for making them lie. Abraham Hoagland Cannon, an LDS apostle, I put it in quotes, took Annie Cannon after President Woodruff permitted him to do so in 1984 after the manifesto. Annie was taken as a concubine. Leaders pondered this practice because the revelation to Joseph about plural marriage mentioned that the Lord approved of concubinage. George Q. Cannon said, "I believe in concubinage or some plan whereby men or women can live together under sacred ordinances and vows until they can be married. Concubinage would provide a way to take care of our surplus girls." Isn't he thoughtful? He's a sensitive man. "And to multiply and replenish the earth." 15 lines are cut out of Cannon's diary for October 1894, where the suggestion regarding concubinage was made. And so the present cover-up going on is there is no access to George Q. Cannon's diary to find out what else he may have said about concubinage or how widespread the practice was, unknown to historians today. Fake divorces attempted to mislead authorities. The logic was fake divorce was necessary to live the higher law of polygamy. The theology, earthly marriage or divorce was not binding in heaven anyway. And so if you're getting into trouble with the federal government because you're out of compliance, get a divorce. Doesn't count anyway in God's eyes. The Smoot hearings, congressional hearings from 1904 to 1907. Held by the Senate to determine if U.S. Senator-elect Reed Smoot should be seated in the U.S. Senate, since there was plenty of evidence that Latter-day Saints had not been compliant when it came to their promises to repeal the practice of plural marriage. And so this, I just took a few things. This is a gold mine if you want to find lots of information about lying for the Lord under oath. Under oath, Apostle John Henry Smith testified he couldn't remember his own birth date, as well as other easily recalled facts. I think some of them were the names of his children and the names of his wife and where he lived. Just nothing. Some apostles were declared to be too sick to travel, but they traveled anyway. Longer distances than it would have been to come to Washington, D.C. And so it's carried on because if loyalty trumps honesty, and if it is your duty to do whatever you have to protect the prophet and the leaders and the church, then you just have to find an appetizing or a more pleasant way to say it in our day and age. in the official church curriculum. That's a continued cover-up. In the church education professional development program that I participated in, we were told that doctrine is anything that is in a church publication that the church has published, except for the church magazines, so that they can have plausible deniability. That means Talmage's Jesus the Christ, which the church published in, is it 1915? First? Is considered doctrine, but something published by Bookcraft or Deseret Book or some other publisher is not. You may consider that to be the general authority's own opinions. And so we were told to use that as a guide because we were supposed to be the doctrinal conveyors of truth to the students. And so Joseph Fielding Smith said about the official church history, the most important history in the world is the history of our church, and it is the most accurate history in the world. However, the official history leaves out some important aspects of Smith's personality. He did not adhere to the word of wisdom. He was a serial adulterer. He bedded girls as young as 14. He used character assassination when his embarrassing behavior was revealed. And his prophecies did not come true. So some of them were retroactively reworked to make them look as if they had come true or simply not included. Brigham Young was determined to paint those who challenged Smith's authority as traitors and liars. And so the church curriculum and church histories reflect that also. 60% of the history was written after Smith's death, but made to sound like he wrote it from his own journal accounts. The extermination order. What a lot of people don't realize, it was first threatened by the Latter-day Saints. 3 months before, the extermination was ordered by Governor Lilburn W. Boggs. I'm not justifying it, I'm just saying you ought to see both sides. Section 98 of the Doctrine and Covenants is basically a law of retaliation, where God gives you permission to go hunt down and kill your enemies after the third offense. There's a little more about the extermination order. This is what Sidney Rigdon said in his famous 4th of July speech. And that mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination. For we will follow them until the last drop of their blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us. For we will carry the seed of war to their own houses and their own families, and one party or the other shall be utterly destroyed. Smith approved of the speech, and it was printed in the Far West, a weekly newspaper, and the church's elders' journal. The church had its own war department. The church was, they had a secretary of war, their prophet and president. In the Nauvoo period, what was his rank? Yeah, king. Yeah, it was. He was had himself. Yeah. And lieutenant general, or which kind of? Lieutenant general. And was he the first one since George Washington that had held that office? Huh? Was it? Okay, well, whatever he was. Yeah. How'd that work? Commander-in-chief for the Zion's camp. That's right. Yeah. And so there's a real militaristic and culture of violence. The Lord would fight their battles, Smith said, and avenge their enemies until the third and fourth generation. The highest ranking Mormon charged with murder was Apostle Parley P. Pratt during the Missouri conflict. He killed one Missourian and then severely wounded militiaman Samuel Tarwater. Some of the Danites mutilated the unconscious Tarwater with their swords, striking him lengthwise in the mouth. cutting off his under teeth and breaking his lower jaw, cutting off his cheeks and leaving him for dead. He survived to press charges against Pratt for attempted murder. His nickname was Lucky. This is from Benjamin F. Johnson, quoted by D. Michael Quinn in The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power. The innocent Missouri females hastily took from the houses what they could carry, and among the women was one young married and apparently near her confinement, and another with small children and not a wagon, and many miles away from any of their friends. And snow had begun already, had already begun to fall. But I would in no degree let them deter me from my duty. So while others were pillaging for something to carry away, I was doing my best to protect. And he talks about more about the victims. Before noon, we had set all on fire and left upon a circuitous route towards home. Boyd Packer. Okay. You seminary teachers, the mantle is far, far greater than the intellect. You know this talk. You seminary teachers and some of you institute and BYU men will be teaching the history of the church this school year. The general authority that interviewed me when I became a seminary teacher in 1975 in my interview in Vancouver, Washington, I had traveled down from Yakima, where I was living. He was the general authority that interviewed me. Packer was. And one of the interview questions was, had you ever been arrested? And I said, no. And he said, should you have been? I want to confess before the internet audience, I lied. I said, no. Because I couldn't think of anything I should have been arrested for. But after the thing, after the interview, I thought lots of stuff. Okay. You know how we cook the facts and our memories try to make us look good? Yeah. This is an unparalleled opportunity, Packer said, in the lives of your students to increase their faith and testimony of the divinity of this work. Your objective should be that they will see the hand of the Lord in every hour and every moment of the church from its beginning till now. Translation, kids must believe in infallible prophets. I know that's true, and I'll argue with anybody who says differently because I had zone administrators on the phone tell me, not using those same words, but using the cagey, elusive, plausible deniability rhetoric that they use to threaten you and warn you that you would better fall in line or else. These are the marching orders. Don't go thinking you can slide in other stuff from objective histories. We won't let you get away with it, Buster. There is a temptation for the writer or the teacher of church history to want to tell everything, whether it's worthy or faith-promoting or not. Some things that are true are not very useful. I found that to be true in my life. That historian or scholar who delights in pointing out the weaknesses and frailties of present or past leaders destroys faith. A destroyer of faith, particularly one within the church, and more particularly one who is employed specifically to build faith, places himself in great spiritual jeopardy. Do not spread disease germs. When is the last time you heard truth equated with disease germs? Translation, you'll lose, and all of us CES guys knew it. You'll lose your job, income, family, security if you don't keep quiet about embarrassing church history. Dallin Oaks said, it's one thing to depreciate a person who exercises corporate power or even government power. It's quite another thing to criticize or depreciate a person for the performance of an office to which he has been called of God. It does not matter that the criticism is true. This is another loyalty is more important than honesty. He said, continuing, in a different place. I can't remember if that was a different place or not. A different principle applies in our church, where the selection of leaders is based on revelation, subject to the sustaining vote of the membership. In our system of church government, evil speaking and criticism of leaders by members is always negative. Whether the criticism is true or not, it tends to impair the leader's influence and usefulness, and thus working against the Lord and His cause, virtually making leaders unaccountable. Boyd Kirkland, ordinary member of the church, who wrote in the letters to the editor of this volume of dialogue you see here, and entitled Building the Kingdom with Total Honesty, I just brought a few extracts. It's too good. He had been writing the first presidency about the Adam God doctrine, saying, you keep getting up in conferences saying that members of the church are going to be punished for believing in it or talking about it or teaching it. And you deny that Brigham Young ever taught it. So he sent him all this information. He said, he did teach it. He was being very kind and very nice, and he wasn't publicizing his letters. It was all just between the first presidency and him. Michael Watson, who was the secretary at the time to the first presidency, finally had a meeting with him. He had several meetings, but Brother Watson showed me a memo written by Brother, that would be Mark E. Peterson, to the first presidency with his recommendations as to how to respond to me. He informed them that the issues I had raised were real, that Brigham Young had indeed taught these things. They could not acknowledge this, lest I would trap them into saying that this therefore meant Brigham was a false prophet, which they did not believe, of course. He therefore recommended that I be given a very circuitous response evading the issue, which he, Peterson, volunteered to write. I asked Brother Watson, said Boyd Kirkland, as well as members of the committee I had previously met with, how this approach would help people like myself who knew better. Wasn't there a concern that some might be dismayed and disillusioned by their church leaders' lack of candor? They said, in essence, if a few people lose their testimonies over this, so be it. It's better than letting the true facts be known. Gordon B. Hinckley, do you teach that God was once a man? I wouldn't say that. There was a little couplet coined, as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become. Now, that's more of a couplet than anything else. That gets into some pretty deep theology that we don't know very much about. Here's Gordon B. Hinckley standing for something with a Time magazine interview. When I was in CES once, I was in charge of this group of region guys and their in-service and stuff. And I was supposed to send out this information about a big area mid-year conference we were going to have. And everyone was instructed to read standing for something. And so I wrote this memo out to the 10 guys that I was in charge of. Some were seminary guys, some were institute. I said, it suggested that we read the book and come ready to discuss Gordon B. Hinckley standing for something. And I said, please don't be fooled, because there's another book by President Hinckley's brother called Sitting for Nothing. And so, don't get the wrong book. So, you know, stupid junior high humor. And if it raises to that level, and then some guy contacted my area director, who visited with me personally and said that that was demeaning to President Hinckley and that I should apologize to all the brethren in my area because it might have misled some of them. So, you know what? It was worth it. It was sitting for nothing. That's funny. Okay. Oh, man, I love it. I don't know that we teach it. Same principle. I don't know that we emphasize it. I haven't heard it discussed for a long time in public discourse. I don't know. I don't know all the circumstances under which that statement was made. I understand the philosophical background behind it, but I don't know a lot about it, and I don't know that others know a lot about it. Standing for something. Paul Richards, who left BYU in 1992 as the spokesman, said, I worked in public affairs for the church for 13 years. I had to lie all the time. What does the research on lying say? Let's cover some of these areas. University of Massachusetts psychologist Robert Feldman, who's been studying lying for decades. Lying boils down to the shifting sands of the self, trying to look good both to ourselves and others. Feldman says, it's tied in with self-esteem. We find that as soon as people feel that their self-esteem is threatened, they immediately begin to lie at higher levels. A new study finds that a sense of moral superiority can lead to unethical acts such as cheating. In fact, some of the best do-gooders can become the worst cheats. For example, somebody could rationalize cheating on a test as a way of achieving their dream of becoming a doctor and helping people. Politicians will frequently rationalize saying something during their campaign so they can get elected and then do good. In November's 2007 issue of the Journal of Applied Psychology, researchers found that when this line between right and wrong is ambiguous among people who think of themselves as having high moral standards, the do-gooders can become the worst of cheaters. And we saw this in the history. When you think you're doing it for a pure and noble cause, you can rationalize nearly anything. You remember Stanley Milgram's experiments where he wanted to find out why Nazi Germany, everyday citizens and others were so willing to carry out Hitler's orders to kill and torture. And so he set up this experiment that you all see on grainy videotape in Psychology 101, where someone is giving nonsense lists of questions to somebody on the other side who they can't see. And the person, if they answer it wrong, they give them an electric shock. And then they turn up the dial that's very, very clearly says, you know, where there's a lethal amount of electric shock. And in one case, if the first study he did, he even had the man on the other side screaming and crying at some point saying, I've got a heart problem. I've got a heart condition. You are killing me. Please stop. You're killing me. Stop it. For God's sake, stop. 63% of those engaged in the experiment who thought they were giving lethal doses of electric shock, they really weren't, actually did follow through because someone dressed in a lab coat, turned out to be a biology teacher, told them to. Now, imagine the impact of an authority figure, the stature of Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, or today, Thomas S. Monson and the 12 apostles, and how little children are indoctrinated every single minute of every day of their lives to believe that these men are nearly infallible and godlike. What impact does that kind of an authority figure have on them? If a stranger dressed in a lab coat carrying a clipboard can say, give it to him. Something to think about. The Lucifer Effect by Philip Zimbardo for many, many years. He's the one who did the Stanford prison experiments. A host of situational forces can dominate an individual's will to resist evil. Zimbardo suggests that we see evil in incremental terms as something of which we're all capable, depending on the circumstances. People aren't bad apples as much as they are in a bad barrel, an environment where particular social forces promote lying and worse forms of victimization. These insular societies, these insular cultures where it's almost like living in a silo where everything you hear and see and read about and everybody you interact with is promoting the same agenda. What are those systems? Group pressures, obedience to authority, dehumanization of others, always them and us, always polarized, dominant ideologies and groupthink enable illegitimate ends to justify deceitful means. Tavris and Aronson. Self-justification permits us to hold two contradictory ideas. An example of cognitive dissonance is, I know it's dangerous to smoke. I smoke 2 packs a day. Or, it's a sin to lie, but the Lord justifies lying to protect his church. The cognition that I'm a sensible, competent person is dissonant with the cognition that I went through a painful procedure to achieve something, and these are their words, say joining a group that turned out to be a big mistake and worthless. Therefore, I would distort my perceptions of the group in a positive direction. I would find good things about them and ignore or explain away, any way I could, the downside. The elite do have more to lose, and Tavris and Aronson talk about all the folks and give examples in their book where individuals have refused to admit mistakes. Keep awareness, they say, of the difference between our ideal selves and our real selves. Now, it's a sense of humility is really what it is. I'm not all that. We cannot learn from our misdeeds if we refuse to admit wrongdoing and take full responsibility for it. All of us share the impulse to justify. The higher the stakes, the greater the difficulty. And then look at the bottom line. This is from their book. Even irrefutable evidence is rarely enough to pierce the mental armor of self-justification. In closing, there was an auction at an assisted living facility. An immaculately coiffed female resident stepped to the podium and held up her hand, and she said, "Whomever can guess what I hold in the palm of my hand may enjoy an elegant evening of pure pleasure with me in the privacy of my room." Old guy from the back says, "An elephant." Slowly she opened her hand. Slowly she peeked inside and said, "Close enough." We may never be completely honest with ourselves and our loved ones, but we can get close enough if we try very hard. And you all deserve commendation for doing that, for admitting to yourself, for admitting to your children, for admitting to your parents, your spouses, whomever. I can't do this anymore. I don't believe it anymore. I can't go on like this. I got one life. I've got to do what's right. In hopes that we can all do that, in the name of Richard Packham, amen!